My talk today is in vitro immunological models for rapid vaccine assessment. And I hope by the end of my talk I have convinced you that there is a possibility of doing a clinical trial in a test tube. So to introduce you to Vax Design is a small biotech company that was founded in 2003. We're about 40 plus employees, many with advanced degrees and immunological background for most of them. We have collaborated with a number of academic and industrial leaders in the field of immunology over the course of our existence, and we've been funded by government, non-government organizations, and certainly many commercial sources as well. Vax Design has been fortunate in receiving a Research and Development 100 Award, a very prestigious award, Schwartz Award for Business Innovation. And to give you a bit of a background to what our scope is, Vax Design has developed a system that we call the MIMIC system. The MIMIC system is one that we hope recapitulates immune responses in vivo in an in vitro setting. The way we've done this is we have several modules to the MIMIC system, one of them being the innate immune response, or what we call the peripheral tissue equivalent module, PTE. An adaptive immune response module, which is what happens in a lymph node, and we call that the lymphoid tissue equivalent module. And then we also have functional assays that we use to assess whether the antibodies that are being produced or the cellular responses that we're seeing in our system are actually indeed efficacious or of some function. And of course, we can look at antibody forensics by a variety of means, and I'll touch on a bit of those as well, and then I'll expose you to how we've automated our system to make it a high-throughput system, which can be used to look at several hundred compounds at a time. Of course, that becomes very important for any pharmaceutical company, that is looking to down-select the number of molecules that they want to get into clinical trials. Certainly, if you're going to fail in any clinical trial, it's best to fail early because then it's cheaper. So we have, how do we get our cells for constructing our immunological modules? We have a system whereby we leukapherese donors. We have solicited numbers of donors. We pay them handsomely. They come in. They go to the local blood bank. We don't give them tea and a biscuit, unfortunately, but we do give them some monetary means to help with their donations. And so we leukapherese these people, and we get about 10 to 12 billion white blood cells, which are the immune cells, circulating immune cells in the body. And that's our donor system. Our donor system is comprised of males and females of all ages and all ethnic backgrounds. So we can, in a sense, design a trial or a series of tests that encompass gender-specific requirements or age-specific requirements if we need to. Certainly, simulating the innate immunity with a peripheral tissue module, we have a particular construct that I'll describe in a little bit that looks at innate immunity and certainly adaptive immunity, what happens in a lymph node where you have B and T cell lymphocytes, and how those cells interact with the antigen processing cells, and then, of course, functional tests, as I mentioned. So one of the nice things about our system is we use primary cells. We don't use cell lines. The primary cells that we use are autologous for each test. And what I mean by that is we maintain the autonomy of the individual donor in the test from the beginning to the end. So the response that we see in any particular test remains the response of that individual's cells. So we have such a diverse population of our donors that we feel that we get a representative sampling of what how a population dynamics are in response. So we hope this will help faster cycle times for discovery. We certainly see that it can enable down selection of vaccine candidates, and it's certainly a new way of designing clinical trials. And as I mentioned, it reduces the time and cost involved. So to give you a little bit of background as to what happens in a vaccine response or a response to a challenge with a pathogen. We have exposure to pathogens all the time, whether you've gotten a splinter, whether you went and got your flu shot this year, or whether it's just a normal bacterial flora that we have that we see all the time. The peripheral tissue module recapitulates how the cells, in this particular case, the antigen processing cells, come into the area where the vaccine or the antigen is seen and how they respond to that, and we're going to discuss that right now. So the way this occurs is you have monocytes that cross vascular endothelial cells, and these vascular endothelial cells are one of the signals that help monocytes come into the area. They help neutrophils come into the area. There are a variety of cytokines that are produced by the local milieu in any case, even in sentinel cases where these cells are just migrating through on a normal everyday basis. These monocytes then differentiate into dendritic cells, or DCs, and these DCs are what are capable of processing the antigen and carrying it downstream. These cells we have shown to be identical to cells that are in human dermal explants, where there are three subpopulations of cells, of dendritic cells, the immature cells, the immature CD14 negative DCs, and what we call mature DCs, as well as macrophages. All of these cells are generated autonomously when they cross the endothelial cells. We don't use cytokines like many people do. They'll use GM-CSF or IL-4 to drive monocytes to become dendritic cells, and we do not do that because we feel that this is a more representative manner of generating APCs. The list of markers that we use here on the right are what we have looked at in the past to generate data saying that these cells are, in fact, exactly like the ones that are found in skin. So the PTE module replicates innate immune responses to adjuvants and immunopotentiators, things that are added to vaccines that help vaccines work better, and we'll look at a little bit of that data. It helps the response profile of vaccines. We have looked at the PTE module in looking at biological compounds, small molecules, cosmeceuticals, and immunosuppressants, for example, dexamethasone, cyclosporin. All of these molecules seem to function in the PTE module as they do in vivo. Cytokines are one of the mainstays that we look at. We can look at pro-inflammatory cytokines, cytokines that drive a Th1 response or a response that would be more towards producing antibodies that are used to reduce a pathogen or help protect us against a pathogen, as well as Th2 cytokines, which would help drive a cytotoxic type response. And if we take a look at what we have here, we have the PTE module data here and the PBMC assay, which is the standard assay of the industry that is the mainstay of what pharmaceutical companies do. And not to belabor a lot of the data here, but to show you that, for example, poly-IC, an adjuvant in both the PTE and PBMC assays, provides much more data compared to the PBMC assay. And when we look at for example, CPG, which is an oligonucleotide that is also used as an adjuvant, we see much more diverse response compared to what is typically seen in the PBMC assay. Now, to take all of the data that we've generated into that and to condense it down into one slide, because I am limited by time, so I haven't got a whole lot of time to discuss a lot of this with you. If we look at monocyte-derived DCs, which are generally GM-CSF IL-4-derived, versus how the DCs are generated in the PTE module, and looking at three vaccines, hepatitis B virus vaccine, Fluzone vaccine, which is modified live influenza vaccine, and diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis vaccine, the reactogenicity of these vaccines is hepatitis B vaccine being the least reactogenic, DTaP being the most reactogenic because it has a lot of LPS in there from the acellular pertussis, as well as it's a trivalent vaccine. The Fluzone, being a modified live, is a live vaccine, which in itself is more reactogenic than the very benign hepatitis B vaccine. And that is typically what is seen if you've gotten a shot lately. If you've gotten a tetanus shot, you know it hurts like a son of a gun. Whereas if you've had a hepatitis B shot, it's pretty innocuous and it's not really one to worry about. The type of DCs that are generated in the presence of alum, there's a lot of question as to whether alum is toxic at certain levels. In our system, we have found that even levels up to therapeutic levels of what's used in vaccines, it generally doesn't show any signs of toxicity. But it does if we look at cytokine response. We get diminution of cytokine response for these various vaccines with different concentrations of alum. If we look at how the MMIC system PTE module can aid in determining if a vaccine with an adjuvant is going to be effective or not, in this particular case, we have no antigen. In this particular case, we have the hepatitis B vaccine in a standard formulation. And then we had hepatitis B surface antigen by itself with one dose of alum and hepatitis B surface antigen with a second dose of alum that's a higher concentration. And we can see that, in fact, by increasing the alum, increasing the stimulation of the APCs, will give us a better response, typically exactly what's seen in vivo. Now that you are familiar with the peripheral tissue module, now we're going to go to the next module, which is exactly what happens in a local lymph node. So you got the shot in the arm, the antigen processing cells came into where the shot was received, picked up the antigen, modified the antigen, and is now ready to present that antigen to the lymphocytes that are in the local draining lymph node, such as the axillary lymph node. And that's what we're going to talk about now, is the reactions that occur in the lymphoid tissue equivalent. This just recapitulates what I just said. So the lymphoid tissue equivalent is a three-dimensional construct that we have developed that recapitulates the interactions of B and T lymphocytes with antigen processing cells in vivo, this being a cross-sectional hematoxylin and eosin stain of a local lymph node germinal center. We can recapitulate that in vivo where we get the same type of information that's passed from one cell type to another cell type. So the key cells that we have in our system are dendritic cells, follicular dendritic cells, and of course B and T lymphocytes, because those are the cells that are mainly involved in responses in the lymph node. Now what we have found is that there is a particular sequence of how these cells talk to each other in vivo, which is what we recapitulate in vitro. It doesn't do well in our system if we take antigen or DCs that have been pulsed with antigen and just plop them in with the lymphocytes. There is a particular order, a particular timing that occurs in vivo, and we have tried to recapitulate that, and I'll show you some data that supports this in just a moment. So at the right time, in the right order, and in a system that's automatable and reproducible is always key. In this particular case, we're looking at tetanus-specific antibody responses at days 14 and day 7, comparing our MMIC system with the standard PBMC assay in culture using the same number of cells, the same amount of antigen, and whatnot. Well, we remove NK cells, natural killer cells, and CD8-positive T cells because, and monocytes as well, because these cells are a confounding factor. Many times people will be tested for using a PBMC assay for a particular vaccine that they have seen in the past, and they show no response. And we feel the reason that they show no response in the standard PBMC assay is because all of these other inhibitory cells are there that are generally not there in a lymph node in vivo.
In this particular case, this donor had a high titer, anti-tetanus titer, yet by the PBMC assay, he showed no response. Showing you some data with influenza-specific antibody responses, by delaying our culture system as to when we put the antigen or the dendritic cells that are pulsed with antigen with the B cells in the system, we see that for Fluzone or for a virus alone, we get a much higher response in delaying the addition of these cells to the culture. So we're trying to mimic what happens in vivo. So in correlating recall responses, for example, this is a series of donors that had previously been tested to find out what their serum levels were for hepatitis B surface antigen antibodies, and then generating results in the mimic system and looking at antibodies that were produced or antigen-specific cells that were secreting antigen-specific antibody to the hepatitis B surface antigen, we found a high correlation between the number of high responders in that had a high titer to the number of high responders that we saw in the LTE. Those that showed very little or no antibody to hepatitis B surface antigen also showed low response as far as antigen-specific secreting cells in the mimic system. So how does this relate to the general population? Everybody that deals in vaccinology knows that not everybody responds the same way because people are different. Everybody in this room, I would be willing to say, would respond differently to a vaccine if we chose one particular vaccine, for example, yellow fever. I'm not going to talk about yellow fever. But I will talk about tetanus because everybody here has had a tetanus shot at some point in time in their life. And for vaccinologists, they know tetanus is one of those that people, even though they are protected, may not show effective levels of antibody. So at the bottom here, we have different donor numbers, and we have taken and done an examination of 2 days, day 7 and day 12, whether they were pre-vaccination as well as post-vaccination. So in other words, we apherese these people, we take their cells, we freeze them back, and now we can call those pre-vaccination for whatever vaccine we want, and in this particular case, we sent them off to get vaccinated for tetanus, and then 2 months later, we brought them back and we apheresed them again, and now we froze those back, and then we can run our test when we have enough donors at pre- and post-vaccinated for any particular vaccine. So we can now look pre- and post-vaccine all at the same time to see how this corresponds to what their titers are for serum titers for anti-tetanus antibody. And you'll see here that the pre and post are dramatically different throughout the donor population, which is exactly what we see in the population as far as serum titer levels. So in taking all of that data and putting it together, what we have is that day 7, pre and post, day 12, pre and post, and we look at, in this particular case, the number of antigen-secreting cells, antibody-secreting cells that were secreting anti-tetanus antibody. If you're really into vaccines, producing antibody doesn't really mean anything unless you're producing the right type of antibody. And anybody that knows anything about immunology, which I don't claim to be an immunologist, but I know a smattering amount, and that gets me through most of the time, you want to have class switching because the first antibodies that are produced are of IgM class. IgM class is a pentameric high molecular weight antibody that is in transition to a more specific antibody, in this particular case, IgG. And then it could be IgE, it could be IgD, it could be a whole host of other things that we're not going to get into. But suffice to say, to make protective antibodies, you have to have the class switching mechanism turned on, so it actually is producing an antibody that's efficacious in the system. And in this particular case, and this really should be earlier time point, 7 days and 12 days, where we're seeing high IgM production and then high IgG production later on. So we do have the mechanisms in place to show that we're indeed having class switching. And that's exactly what this particular slide is, only it happens to be against Bacillus anthracis recombinant protective antigen that we were using as our antigen of choice here. Now we're going to talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we test these cells or how we test these antibodies in vitro to determine if they're going to be effective in vivo. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the antibodies we're producing will be protective in a human, but it gives us some indication as to how the human would respond if they were given this particular antigen. We do that by having essentially different types of disease models. And I actually had a whole lot of slides in this section, and I cut them all out because they were very detailed and very boring, I'm sure. But if you have any questions about this, I would be more than happy to entertain them at any point in time. Simply put, when we look at B-cell antibody production, the easiest way for us to test that is it a neutralizing antibody? Is it an antibody that will effectively neutralize the pathogen of choice? And for T-cells, the magnitude of the T-cell response, we do a lot of CFSE labeling. For those of you who know what that is, if we load a cell up with CFSE and it divides and these cells proliferate, a certain amount, in fact, typically half of the CFSE will be given to the daughter cells. And if they divide again, half there. So you can see the progression of cell proliferation by the decrease in the amount of CFSE labeling that you have in your cell population. That's one method that we use to measure that. Of course, CD8 positive T cells are killer cells, and we can look at their effect as well. We definitely examine cytokine secretion because cytokines give us an indication of the degree of inflammatory response that these cells are being